Hey everybody, this is Adam with Talking Comics. I'm here today with Jim Zub and Stephen Cummings. They're the writer and artist on Image's Wayward. So hey guys, how you doing?
We're doing well. Hey,
doing great. Nice to be here.
And we've never done an audio interview in person before together. This is pretty great.
This is wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, we're here in Japan. We're in a pub. So if you hear background music, that's what that is. And you guys are just at a con 3-4 days ago?
Comitia.
I didn't want to say that.
Yeah.
Properly. It sounds true.
The Comitia over at the Tokyo Big Site. So we were there. It's just a one-day show, and it's the first time we'd ever signed Wayward together. It was a really cool experience.
Yeah, it was the first time I'd seen you in like 5 years.
Yeah, very strange. The book had launched. We launched Wayward in summer of 2014, late summer, and we hadn't seen each other in person. You know, we haven't seen each other, yeah, like you said, like 5 years. So
yeah.
It's been amazing being here in Japan finally and doing some promotion, but also just kind of relaxing and doing some research for the book and doing some sightseeing as well.
Awesome. So you said it's been 5 years since you guys have seen each other. How did you guys, well, let's go back even further. How did your careers kind of start and how did you guys kind of come together?
Okay, you go first.
I was a student here in college. I was in grad school. And I'd always wanted to be a comic book artist. I loved it as a kid. I probably should have aimed higher. And so I was in college here, and I went to grad school after graduating. I was an exchange student from American school, and when I graduated, I came back to the same school and went to grad school.
And you took art in school, by the
way? No, I was in a Department of East Asian Political something, because I wanted to get into the linguistics department, but for some reason I wasn't able to. I think my timing was bad. And so I was in grad school, and I was in it for about a day when I realized I'd made a mistake and I needed to draw comic books. And so instead of writing the research papers I was supposed to, I would just sit around drawing, and I would take my things to the publishers in Japan, and I'd show my stuff, and the response was always, "You're a foreigner, so there's the door."
Right.
And it took me a long time to find a publisher who would actually even want to work with me. And after working with them for like a year on a pitch, I got called in for a meeting, and I thought, oh, they're finally going to greenlight me. And they sat me down and said, "We're never going to hire you." I talked to my editor-in-chief, and he said, "You're a foreigner, so there's the door." And about that time, I got this amazing call at 4 in the morning from Scott Dunbier. At the time, he was at, I think, Homage.
Homage, before they became Wildstorm.
Or it might have been Wildstorm at that point. I don't remember. This was in 2000 and...
They were Wildstorm by that point.
Okay, so this is 2001. It's a little before 9/11 has happened, and anyway, I get this phone call, and apparently this friend of mine in America who I've been sending my samples to has been taking them to conventions and showing them to editors and standing in the art line where people are hoping to get jobs, and he's been saying, "Oh, this isn't me, this is for a friend," and all these editors think he's really, really bashful. And so I get this phone call that wakes me up, and this guy is going, "Steven, okay, so I'm looking at your stuff, and I don't like the way you draw hands, but Superman looks cool, and so, yeah, we were talking the other day about this, and mine, do you remember?" And I'm like, it's 4 in the morning, and I'm like, "The fuck is, who is this guy?" And eventually, I figure out he's from a comic company, because he says, "My boss, Jim Lee," and I'm like, "Oh, wait, okay, now that name is making sense." And, yeah, he says, "Come back and you can work for us right away." And I'm like, "Oh, right." And then 9/11 happens. And we can't get my wife's visa for about a year because of security change. Anyway, we get to America, and of course, he no longer, that offer's no longer around. But I got lucky and I got hired by DC right away on comic book.
Who's your editor on that?
DC?
Yeah.
That was Bob Schreck.
Oh, nice.
But I was working actually with his assistant, not him.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of Marvel and DC and a lot of role-playing game art. And then I started doing creator-owned. I was Tokyo Pop, which... Yeah, and then... eventually, I'm looking for something to do, and I finally did it on the website. And I'm like, I like the vibe here, so I just send them a random sample, and I immediately get contacted, and they say, "Come to San Diego, you can meet us." And when I went to San Diego, I met Jim.
Yeah, so here's sort of the other side of that. I guess then we got to the connection point. So my background's originally in animation. So I love comic books, but don't really see a way into that industry, especially when I was growing up. It felt like you either had to live in New York City or you had to be British and very, very amazing in order to sort of break into comics. You had to be Alan Moore or Neil Gaiman, or you had to live in New York City or something,
right,
as far as I could tell. So I was focused on animation. I love animation, and I looked at the companies that were doing animation. There were hundreds of names there. I'm like, I don't think I could be one or two people that are making comics on a credit, but I could probably be one of 100 people that are, you know, in a studio making animation. There's a school just outside Toronto that was teaching classical animation, and it was quite well known. They'd had people working from, you know, at Disney or ILM and all kinds of different companies. And so I ended up applying there. I didn't get in the first time. I took a year of film and multimedia and all sorts of other stuff, and eventually got into animation, the school I wanted. Finished up there, worked for a couple different Canadian animation studios, some success, some failures, trying to figure things out, like how, you know, the industry was going through a real flux because computer animation, 3D animation was taking over, and I had classical animation skills.
Right.
So I realized, oh God, I have to go back to school and retrain in order to really be competitive in this business. And that fall, I was getting ready to go back to school, but I had one summer where my goal was to not spend money. And a friend of mine who I had worked with at a different company, he was working for the Udon Studio. It was Omar Dogan. And so he introduced me to the guy that runs Udon, Eric Koh. And Eric hired me for a summer job. And that summer job turned into 9 years of working at the studio.
Wow.
So I started off as a colorist, and then I moved over to doing some illustration. And then I started helping organize things around the studio. And by the time I met Steven, I was kind of an art director. So the company was split into kind of two halves. There was publishing, which was doing like the Street Fighter comics and doing, in some cases, artwork for like Marvel books like Deadpool or Sentinel or stuff like that. And the other half of the company was called Creative Services. So it was artwork for commercial art, concept art for movies or video game artwork, advertising artwork, role-playing game artwork, all kinds of stuff. And so I was heading up that end of things. That was my kind of division. It makes it sound like a really big company, but it was just like, you know.
Right.
We were doing work for everyone from, you know, Hasbro to Wizards of the Coast and White Wolf Publishing and this is stuff from Microsoft and just you name it. Every week it felt like there was a different project that needed to get done and someone was calling us. Or we'd work with an art director successfully at one company, they'd move to a bigger company and then we'd just start working with them there. So we did stuff for Warner Brothers and Mattel and, I mean, Capcom, of course, you know, through Street Fighter.
Right.
Just everything, all the time. And we were always looking for more artists to expand our kind of pool, both stylistically and also just when the crunch was on, we really needed more people. And so we had kind of open portfolio call, but most of the stuff we would receive was just, let's be honest, it was dreck. Like, it was really bad anime knockoff kind of art. And so when Steven sent us samples, and it was really high quality, and it was beautiful, and it had a real technical quality to it, particularly in the backgrounds. I see a lot of people who can draw characters through sheer repetition, but when you see how they draw environments, you see all the weaknesses in their work come out. And Steven's stuff was just rock solid. It was just beautifully drawn and technically well drawn. And so I knew he could do the work. And so I wanted to meet him. And so we reached out to him and then, you know, ended up meeting him in person and all that. And so that struck up kind of our working relationship at Udon, where I was sending him work, you know, freelance work all the time.
Yeah. I messed up the very first thing you sent me. I got the portions wrong.
That's right. Oh, man. But it was a good drawing, and digital Photoshop saves the day.
Yeah. Yep.
But it's sort of funny, too, because you start working with someone, and even though they're not in person, you build up a relationship with them, a working relationship.
Right.
And so Steve and I got along really well, and every artist has got their own idiosyncrasies, right? And I do too, as an artist, as a creator. And so I just got used to how everyone works. And you see people that you gel with. And Steven and I really gelled well. So what year is that? I mean, we're talking,
I think it was 2007.
Yeah. So we worked on a bunch of stuff for about I guess about 3 years we were working on various freelance projects together.
Okay.
I had a stable of about a dozen artists I would regularly
mm-hmm.
use. And if we were under the crunch, I could pull in another 8 or 10 guys that we would work with. And so in 2010, it was the 10th anniversary of the studio, Abudon. And I had an idea. I wanted to put together a book called Vent.
Yep.
And what it was supposed to, I mean, we were all doing commercial artwork all the time. But all of us had our own ideas, things we always wanted to do, things we always wanted to create.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, wouldn't it be cool to celebrate a decade of the studio? We'll put together this kind of high concept art book. It'll be part tutorial, part kind of dream project book, and a celebration of these are the people that make Udon great. And my boss, Eric, he was really cool about it. He basically let us sink a bunch of money into doing this thing, just as like a celebration of our hard work.
Right.
And everyone did different illustrations or short stories to sort of show off their dream project, what they would do if they had no editorial interference, what they would do on their own time if they were getting paid to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Steven did this illustration of this teenage girl standing at the top of stairs with these spiked bats and all these weird creepy cats hanging around her.
Right.
And
it's like the cover of...
It is the cover
Wayward
to Wayward Number
One.
It's the act, that's the actual piece.
Except the piece was toned. So
yeah,
it was
in black and white.
Yeah, we colored it for Wayward One, but the actual piece...
The original was toned.
I did a tone tutorial, like how to tone, because everybody else is doing these color tutorials, and you know, I don't have a lot of experience with that.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I can really do is tone, and I had a crap load of tone.
Okay.
So, like
the hand cut stuff.
Yeah.
So I was the editor on this art book, and that one was one of the pieces that just really jumped out at me. I couldn't believe how cool it was. And I was like, what is this story about? He goes, oh, I don't know. I always wanted to do a supernatural story set in Tokyo.
Yeah.
And I was like, awesome. That sounds really cool. Man, I hope you do it. And so... Later that year, I launched Skull Kickers, which was my first image book. So I had been doing all this commercial work for Udon, but I got into this business to make comics, to tell stories, you know? And the opportunity came up for me to finally start making my own comic stories. I did a story for an anthology with another artist named Chris Stevens, which gets a little confusing sometimes because it's Stephen Cummings and then Chris Stevens, so people would always be like confused between the two artists. But Chris and I did this short story of these two monster hunters for this image anthology called Pop Gun. And the publisher at Image at the time, Eric Larson, he really liked it. So he asked us if we wanted to do more. We ended up, Chris got really busy, so I ended up getting another artist on board, and Chris was doing covers, and then Edwin Huang and I launched this book called Skull Kickers in 2010, late in 2010. And it went over well. The first issue sold through 3 printings, and we had a lot of buzz about it. Image was on this new sort of climb at the time. So, you know, obviously when Image launched in, I want to say, 92? Yeah, 92.
That was in high school.
Yeah, they had a, you know, huge boom of, they were the biggest guys in the business, and they went off to form their own company. But over time, they had sort of lost their way. Not that they had, they're not a company that has a corporate mandate.
Right.
They're creator-driven. They're creator-owned. In every way possible. And so they had a bit of a lull in terms of hit titles coming out. They had The Walking Dead, but it would be a few more years before the television show and the huge explosion. I mean, The Walking Dead was doing well,
mm-hmm.
particularly for a black and white, but it wasn't the highs that we're seeing now in the image boom. It's crazy. But it was like this pre-ripple that was happening. So you had books like Chew had come out,
mm-hmm.
John Lehman, and it was getting a lot of buzz. Morning Glories came out from Nick Spencer,
oh, yeah,
and it got a lot of buzz. When Skull Kickers came out, we got some pretty good buzz. And so it was like we were riding this sort of pre-wave of like a, you know, shockwave before the big explosion that was to come. By 2011, 2012, it was just, it felt like Image couldn't lose. Like every book was launching like crazy. And so Skull Kickers really put me on the map for people where they were finally, they could see, you know, that I could tell a story, that I could deliver something consistently.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to get offers for other freelance writing, which was awesome. I always wanted to tell stories first and foremost. And having the art background and working with artists for, you know, almost a decade at that point, meant that I could work well with them. Like I could speak their language. I could write really strong visual scenes that would give them something meaty to work with.
Okay.
You know? And so the artists I was working with on freelance writing were really responding well. Editors loved working with me because I had worked with so many different companies as a project manager / art director. I was usually bringing stuff to the table before they had to ask for it. So reference material or the way I was describing things. They were like, oh, working with you is so,
okay,
so smooth. This is great. And so my writing career was starting to get some real steam. And Steven reached out to me and said, hey, man, I'm finishing up a bunch of work and I'm sick of all the commercial work. I really need to do something creator-owned again. Do you want to team up for a project? We talked about making my own stuff and I would really want to work with you again. I'm like, that would be awesome. What do you want to do? And we just sort of started throwing big ideas back and forth. And I had some, I've got like a little notebook where I jam out brainstorm ideas. And so one of them was for this, I wasn't sure, it was like sort of looking at mythology in the modern world and how we view mythology. And that was, I assumed it was going to be Eurocentric. Like, we'd have unicorns and dragons and stuff like that in Eastern Europe or whatever. And we'd use fairy folk and all that kind of thing. And then Steven was like, I'd like to do something more kind of urban. And I think I said, hey, wait, do you remember that piece from Vent that you did? We should totally use that.
Okay.
And so we started talking about Japanese mythology. And I knew yokai stuff, but not deeply. And Steve and I started talking back and forth about Japanese myths. And I was like, this is great. This works really well. And a bunch of the others. I love Japan. I've been multiple times at that point already. And I would love to dig in on a lot of that mythological stuff. And I would love to take that big thematic idea and put it in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And Steven was excited because he got to kind of draw the city. Because one of the things he said to me, he goes, I hate the way Tokyo is represented in the movies. I hate the way it's represented in North America. It's like, if you were in New York City and the only thing you knew about New York City was Statue of Liberty and Empire State Building and Central Park. And you're like, that's the whole city. And you're like, but there's all sorts of cool neighborhoods and there's boroughs and there's amazing little details that someone who lives there knows. And so Steven said, I want to do that with Tokyo. It's a character in the story. And I was like...
Well, as someone, and I've talked about this before, and if I even wrote in and you put my letter in, but I responded to it as a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And just that, like, oh, this I live here. I know
right.
This place. This is the real Tokyo. And I was skeptical.
Sure.
The first issue. I think I told you this the other day. I was like, oh, great. How are they going to fuck up Japan?
Right.
Excuse
right.
my language. How are they going to F up Japan?
No,
here?
Totally.
You didn't, so...
I have a funny story about that as well. So Zach Davison, who does all the back matter in the book, we met him after the book was solicited. So the Wayward was announced. Image put out a press release and kind of sends that to all four corners. And we were getting good buzz from it right from the get-go. And there's another writer. His name's Brandon Sefford. He did a book at Skybound called Witch Doctor. He's a friend of mine, and he reached out immediately, like the day that the book was announced. And he's like, oh my God, my friend Zach, he's a professional Japanese translator who specializes in monster lore, and he's writing a book on Japanese ghosts. Got to get this guy involved. And I was like, I knew that I wanted to have some back matter in the comic.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually reached out to a couple, because Udon had been translating manga and art books, I had some contacts in that sphere, so I was reaching out to those people. And I thought literally I was going to have to get a different person to write every article. I thought I was going to have to be like, okay, I got to find someone who can write about high school in Japan. Okay, I got to get someone who's going to write about, ghosts, and someone who's going to write about this and write about that. And it was going to be a lot of work to track down the back matter. So I knew I was going to have to start searching really early. So I'd already started reaching out to people. And Brandon just, contacted me out of the blue and said, you got to meet my friend Zach. And so he sends Zach an intro email. And what I didn't know, Zach responded really tersely, like this real short, yeah, cool, man, send me whatever. But what I didn't know is Zach was exactly like you. He's like, oh, God, these guys are going to fuck up Japan. He's, oh, no, these guys didn't think they're going to do Japan right, and they never do, and all this sort of stuff. And so I sent him the material. I sent him the outline. I sent him the first script and a bunch of your artwork. And he... lost his mind. He was so happy because he recognized places,
mm-hmm.
because he could tell that Stephen was doing his due diligence on the visuals,
mm-hmm.
and I was doing my due diligence on the research,
right.
and we were working really hard on this thing. And so he completely turned 180. He went from being like, yeah, maybe I'll check it out, to I have to write the back matter. Don't let anyone else do it. Yeah, I'll take care of everything. And he's been really valuable on that front ever since, where he's been bringing a lot of cool stuff. And he never interferes with the story. He never, it's the character story is our story,
mm-hmm.
but we tell him where things are going, and then he'll respond with like, oh, did you know that this ties into this mythological thing, or these creatures sound like something that would be really useful. So he's always adding to, rather than, you know, trying to tell us we're doing it wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been a really cool relationship that way.
The back matter is a, it's definitely an added bonus.
Oh, sure.
To the book, and
a lot
it's
of people like it.
It's really informative and, I guess, educational in a way. People are interested in that kind of
yeah.
different aspects of the culture. It's not just, like you said, there's some on like Japanese high schools. It's not
yeah.
just the monsters, but
no, some of the best response beyond just monster profiles. The ones that talk about, like, there's one that talks about Neo-Confucianism
mm-hmm.
and roles in society in Japanese life.
Right.
People are just like, whoa, this is mind-blowing stuff if you don't know how it works. You know
right.
what I mean? And it's always something where I know, I've done research on some of it, but that it exemplifies more, and it also keeps us from turning the story into info dump, where I don't have to sit there and have characters broadly explaining cultural stuff.
Right.
We can just roll forward with plot.
No midichlorians.
No midichlorians. No one's saying it. Where does this come from? You know, every so often we would get someone would say something like, wow, geez, you know, O'Hara's really like passive. Why is she putting up with all this stuff? And you're like, no, that's, you know, young schoolgirl in Japan. Not all of them, but enough of them that's a,
right.
a thing that could really happen. And the way that you, that quiet kind of role in society that she has,
mm-hmm.
it happens. It's a real thing. You know, we're not just making this character, I don't even want to use the term weak, because it's not a weakness, but it's like, we're not just making something up. You know
right.
I mean?
It's a cultural thing.
It's
definitely.
Built off of the real stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to the locations, I guess this is a question for Stephen. Do you have free rein on like kind of picking what, where to illustrate, or Jim, do you input where the story is taking place, the setting?
We a lot of, when he's not busy, we have these Skype conversations periodically where we talk about that. And
we drop some Google Earth,
yeah.
like we're casting locations in a movie or something. It's
okay.
Fun.
Yeah, around the time you're working on issue 3. In a random conversation, I mentioned something about abandoned subway tunnels, and Jim says, oh, okay, good, because I need that. There's something coming up, and we can use that. And
there's a lot of that where Steve will throw out something, and then 5 issues later, it shows up in the book. We're just having a conversation, and he'll say, oh, you know, it would be great if there was a kid who could control, like, networks and computers. Like, there's so many, everyone's got a phone everywhere, and
mm-hmm.
that should be something. And I'm like, that is a really good idea. And then it was like 6 issues later,
yeah.
you know, boom, that character shows up in the story, because I could find a way to slowly weave it in organically, you know, Ueno Park. So originally the train went under Ueno Park, and then they eventually rebuilt it, so now it goes around the park, from what you told me.
No. What it is the station they don't use anymore.
Okay.
But the trains actually still run through there. The way we draw it, no train can go through there. Because
right.
Can. But it's still used, but the platform is abandoned. No one goes down there. Nishi, he visited it one time when he was really young.
What?
And then they closed it. They closed it in the 80s, so it's not used anymore. It's,
right.
And there's abandoned subways all over. There's one underneath Akihabara.
Right.
They're all over the place in Tokyo. If you go out in the country, you can actually find abandoned lines.
Yeah.
But in Tokyo, in theory, there's also secret military tunnels and stuff. But that was a real one. It's on the Keio line. Oh, Keisei. It's Keisei Tetsudo. And so that runs from Ueno out, sort of northwest
okay.
for a short distance. And there was a station underneath the park near the zoo. It's just on the other end. I just really wanted to use that, so I told Jim about it. And
and I needed a gathering place for a bunch of yokai for an ambush.
It's also big enough for a fight.
Right, and so I said, I just need, and this would be very organically how it goes. I say, plot wise, here's what I need. I need a place that's visually interesting for a fight. What do you think that's in their neighborhood or is accessible enough that they can do it?
Did you get photos from there? Or do you...
I had to go online for that because you can't get in there.
Right.
There are people who literally did like, what do they call it, geocaching, wherever they go, and they took photos.
Well, I used to teach a student who, his hobby was kind of going to abandoned places. I guess he was breaking the law and trespassing, but and taking photos. That was like his big thrill. So is it like that kind of, those kind of photos? Or?
Well, I don't have, in this case, the photos I used were from the final day. People had posted them, and they just continue to exist online. People keep reposting them. And I found a lot of photo reference of the actual station and the platform from both directions. The platform itself is really interesting because it's staggered like this. It's not like this where you have the platform on either side. It's actually staggered, so they barely overlap.
Okay.
And you can't actually see that in the illustration because there's a train in the way. But it's a really neat looking. It's a really neat looking station because the construction is really unique and it's really old. And even when they closed the station, it was nasty looking. Like, paint had been peeling and water
seepage.
They
had been keeping it up.
I think they knew they were going to close it.
Right, right. But this is what's so cool is we're able to sort of, you know, I can come up with a plot and sort of push forward. So there was like, I needed I said, we're hiding away this, there's a secret location that the Niharion has of the, what do you call it, like the fate machine or whatever, that huge, where all the red strings are pouring into.
Mm-hmm.
It was like issue 3 or 4.
The Loom of Fate.
The Loom of Fate, right. And so I said, we need to hide it in like a warehouse district, something that doesn't look, you know, something inconspicuous or whatever. And you just picked a spot.
Oh, I just picked a random spot. I wanted it to be flat so I didn't have to draw a lot of really tall buildings. And
so,
I chose the area out near Asakusa Sensoji. So it's in theory behind that a ways.
Okay.
So it's basically this one big building in a neighborhood. And the building itself, it's meant to look like it was something from, you know, the 40s from the Showa era, maybe the 50s from the Showa era.
Okay.
And then to decorate it, I put this big Ito on the side of the building, so anybody who knew what it said would be like, oh, it's a, you know, it's a weaving company. They make fabric or something. Okay.
Right. The other one that was cool was, checking all the different, there's so many cool spots that you picked out that have worked really well visually, and I think that that's one of the things that really entices people is it doesn't always feel like it is Tokyo. But for people who have never been there, it gives them a totally different vision. You're not just going into the cliche.
Well, we're skipping the areas around the train stations on purpose.
Right.
Because that's all that gets pictured, like in Western media.
Exactly.
You're going to see mostly Shinjuku, and maybe a little Shinbashu, and
maybe
a little Tokyo station.
Although we did do something where I told Steve to cut down on the amount of anime and manga.
That was an issue one, because I drew
all these
user's guide for the train, because the next train, it has like this emergency exit user guide thing in every seat.
Right.
It was like an airplane, basically, and I had this cute character, and we ended up talking about that and realized that if we go cutesy and have cute, you know, anime characters from the very beginning, we're going to really pigeonhole ourselves.
Well,
right,
people would assume, like, or even when you see it on billboards and stuff, like, it really is in Tokyo all over the place. But because people haven't been there, I think there would be that assumption, like, oh, you guys are just playing up this manga stuff. And we're like, no, it's not. It's really like that, I swear to God.
Right.
So we don't start really introducing that until the second arc, where we start
to
put... when she goes to the Gachapon store and all that. I purposely avoided a lot of that. Like, Rory goes to a manga store in the first one, but it just looks like a bookstore. Like,
it is just a bookstore.
Yeah, okay.
Because they don't have manga shops. There's a few, but not a lot.
Yeah.
You go to a
it's
bookstore.
Just like book off or whatever.
Right.
So I really didn't want people to assume we were playing up the manga and anime thing. So we already almost purposely dialed it back and then slowly like reintroduced it. Almost like, because we were saying, no, we're really doing Japan. Oh yeah, also real Japan has this stuff.
Right.
And for that reason, we skipped Akihabara.
Yeah, so far.
Yeah, so far we've avoided it. If you do it right away, then it's going to set the theme.
People would assume the cliche a lot more. Mm-hmm. If we're going to do it, well, we did have them walk by Nakano, but they didn't go in.
Yeah, they didn't go in. But
that's, yeah, there's our little nod. You've been to Nakano Broadway?
Yeah, there's a, it's kind of a, I guess a smaller Akihabara.
Yeah, it's like a deep nerd mall. Like, it's like, it's
right.
really neat.
It's all specialty stores.
Yeah, super specialized. So,
mm-hmm.
if anywhere, I think we'd use that before we use Akihabara, in my mind, anyways. That's what I like. I like.
It's a really cool Star Wars store.
Yeah, I like, there's a, I like being able to show somewhere a little bit different. You know, we show the abandoned buildings and the schools and homeless areas. Which is something that, of course, no tourist is going to show you.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we went to the abandoned construction sites, you know, like, so it's fun to be able to show different parts of Tokyo and
right.
be able to show a much more in-depth type of city, you know, just different things that people may not have seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And so Steven's able to kind of pull these areas out where I say dramatically, okay, here's what I want. I don't, it's visually distinctive and interesting. You know, I want it to be cool, and I want to have nice stuff to play off of, but I'm focused most on plot and character, and then he's dealing heavily with the where
okay.
it takes place. I mean, there are some places. When she arrives in Ikebukuro East Exit Station, because
yeah.
that's actually the very first station I walked out of when I first arrived in Japan, my very first time.
Mm-hmm.
So I just did that totally indulgently. Like, I was like, that's where she has to arrive, because that's what I want.
I remember coming to Tokyo... And it was the second time I came here. It was Ikebukuro Station
yeah.
coming out that side.
Yeah.
So it was kind of
yeah.
cool.
So I, that was totally indulgent, but that was what I wanted. Yeah, but I usually don't tell you where we're going. I usually don't tell you we have to be here or there. You're usually setting the pace on that.
Yeah, the best example is probably Ryusenji in the second arc, where the kids end up setting up like a base in
mm-hmm.
the temple at the end. And they,
oh,
use that,
and everything?
They use that base through the third arc when it, I'm sure people have read this by now, they lose it because of the fight. And it's a real temple. Like, we needed a temple, and we were going on the theme of the eyes, the eye colors.
Right.
So I just went up to the actual temple with the black eye, which is up near Meguro Station,
mm-hmm.
Daikanyama, or not Daikanyama, crap, what's the name of the station?
Musashiku.
No, it's Fudomai.
Fudomai.
Because
okay.
It's at the Fudo. It's at the actual Fudo shrine. I went up there. I took a lot of pictures, and we just used that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Another example is we needed a temple in the second arc when we find out a little bit about Ayane.
Oh yeah, that one.
That's actually a real temple called Saifuji, and it's in Setagayaku. And a friend of the family lives there. Her father is the priest. And so
cool.
We asked, I was like, hey, can I draw your temple? And they're like, yeah, whatever. But unfortunately, I lost my reference before I started drawing, so I had to, like, wing it. And then I found my reference. So the first picture, there's, like, two giant buildings, when in reality there's only one main building there.
And I'm so disappointed in you. It's so funny, too, because... all that stuff, again, I don't know if anyone knows this. I don't know if most people even realize what goes into it.
No.
But it's important to us, I think. The signage in the background. This is one of the things that Zach said that blew his mind was we didn't finish the first issue. And so Steve doesn't use Photoshop very much. And so he'll pencil out the pages and he'll just have blank signs, like all the store signs.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sends them to me, just the Japanese. And then I slot them in digitally. So when they're in somewhere really busy, there are dozens and dozens of signs I gotta drop in.
Yeah, that scene at Broadway.
Oh my God! And there's like 20, you know, signs in one panel.
Right.
And I'm dropping them all in, and you know, most I think almost any other comic they would have just dropped in bullshit Japanese, right? But everything is like, oh, this is a restaurant, this is a store, this is the laundry, this is the thing. And Zach is like, I keep looking in the background waiting for you guys to screw up. And he goes, you keep doing it. Like, right. Everything's
uh-huh.
correct. All the Japanese is correct, man. You know, so.
Well, only the Japanese readers catch that stuff.
Yeah.
Because in one issue, in issue six, I have in the background when Ohara is getting on the train to go to school. There's a sign that says, Wayward is awesome. And one guy on Twitter, like, posted that. He's like, this is awesome.
There's also stuff, and we don't translate some of the stuff, like, at the start of issue 11, when the Nihiron's walking around, and there's just graffiti spray painted on that sign, and it basically says like "Death to the Yokai" or something like that. And we don't translate it; we just leave it because if people catch it, that's great. There's another one in issue. Can't remember my own issue numbers. Issue 3, right when they meet Nikaido and they go to the
abandoned,
there's spray paint in the background that is that famous Japanese proverb. What's the proverb about the? How would you say in Japanese?
Crap.
You know the one about the. Okay.
I don't actually remember. I'm winging that.
So the gist of it is basically that the, what is it? It's like the frog that's in the pond cannot see the ocean. Doesn't realize the bigger world that they've stepped into,
right.
Which is pretty thematic for these kids, right, in
mm-hmm.
their story. And then the Nihonshoki actually says that line in issue 5.
Yeah.
So he says that later as sort of thematically wrapping it up, but we sort of like weirdly foreshadow it beforehand. It's so funny. So I put that in there early because I knew we were going to bring it back.
Mm-hmm.
And you were like, that's a weird thing for, like, graffiti, someone to get all philosophical in graffiti. And I was like, do it, it'll be great, you know? And people caught it, and they were really into it.
So. No one really said anything here.
Oh, they did. The Kobu asked me.
It's Ironaka no Kaeru, Ou ni o Shirazu.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
The big lake?
The frog inside the well doesn't know about the ocean.
Oh, okay.
It's like in English we'd say to miss the forest for the tree.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Although probably a little different.
Yeah, but that's the gist of it. There's a couple little things like that where we've been able to use, you know, the Japanese specifically as ways to just put little in jokes or funky stuff in there.
Yeah, because I that was for a while I was running out of ideas, so I'd start writing Zelf everywhere. Or I'd write. We have a friend who helps us. I have an editor here who's a really good friend, and. I based a character on him in issue 7.
Oh my god.
We blew him up.
Do you remember the messenger who comes to the temple and then he explodes with spiders out of his body?
Yes, okay.
That is our friend,
Nishi. Yeah. Nishi. And I named him Azuma-kun as a joke. And I write his name a lot. He doesn't even, I don't think he bothers to read the background to like look at the signs. Because otherwise, I have sent him messages and he's never replied.
Oh, so it's so funny. So he said to us, he said he wanted to be a cameo in the book because he's helped us with a bunch of stuff. He's done a lot of the calligraphy. When you see the kanji, when Rory does the magic and you see the kanji.
His mom did one though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Most of them, that's him doing the ink on it.
He's got really good handwriting.
Really
like,
beautiful.
He actually studied calligraphy as a kid.
Oh, wow.
So, anyways, we put him in as a cameo. And then I said, I'm going to kill this messenger. Is that okay? And he goes, yeah, kill him as gory as possible.
We asked him though, how do you want to die? And he said, blow me up.
So I have these spiders burst through his flesh, and I was originally in the, when I paced the issues out, I paced out almost a whole arc at a time. It was originally just the end of a page, and then I rejigged it so it could be a full page splash of him exploding.
Nice.
Just for, and then I said, just draw it, just make it as horrible as possible.
And then the response was really funny. Mr. Blog over at Under the Comic Covers, have you heard what he said?
Yeah, yeah.
He still talks about it. He's got a spider coming out of his leg. What's wrong with you?
That's so fun.
Yeah, that was a friend of ours we blew up. And actually, his sister is mentioned in the social media exchange.
The one
in Tokyo Tower.
Issue 14?
Yeah, because I was asking him.
We're really tangenting hard on this.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's all right.
I asked him a question, and he's like, what are you working on? And I showed him, and he's like, oh, can I write this? I'm going to make my sister in this. And like, she's talking, yeah. And so his sister apparently is talking in one of those
awesome
exchanges.
Very cool. Well, you guys just wrapped up the third arc.
Yeah.
With issue 15.
Yeah.
And the next arc is coming out this fall?
Yeah, so September. We were going to have it come out late summer, and then Steven and I are both really crazy busy, and there's a lot of other stuff on the go, so we're trying to keep... We never want the book to ship late, and so we're trying to get ahead this summer. Plus, I'm here, so it's a great time for us to be able to collaborate and build.
Right. Very cool. If someone was new to Wayward, do you think they should jump on with the newest arc, or should they go back to number one?
They should start at the beginning.
They should start at the beginning,
and
but...
Not because we want their money, but because... there's a lot that's built up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that being said, there is an exchange in issue 16 that purposefully recaps some of the stuff that's happened,
right,
as both a reminder for our current readers and for people to be able to jump in. So you could do it. It's hard because we gloss over a lot, obviously, mm-hmm, in order to get to this point. And in the front of every issue, there's a little quick recap. There's a two-paragraph recap,
right,
on the credit page. But, I mean, the nice thing is about the current comic industry, it's so easy to get access to the early issues, digital in particular.
Oh, yeah, digital's great.
And the price goes down on digital. Like, it's cheaper than the original cover price.
I got the prices here. It's $1.99 for a single issue right now.
Right.
And it's if you buy it direct from Image for the first trade, it's $4.99.
What?
Really?
$7.99 on Comixology for the first trade.
This guy knows his stuff.
And $9.99 if you guys buy the physical copy of the first trade. And I think the second trade is up to $14.99.
I would not have been able to answer any of those questions about the pricing. So,
yeah,
good on you.
I didn't know about that Image.
Nice.
Image Direct.
Yeah, direct from
Image.
And
they've done sales as well. So we've been,
yeah,
a few times they've done a 99 cent sale on Comixology and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And they put us in the Humble Bundle.
Oh, yeah. Image did a Humble Bundle where it's pay what you want. And you got some of the wayward stuff. So
you guys are missing out if you're not buying.
Yeah,
Humble,
yeah. No, it's easy to dive back in. Even the print trade is only $9.99, so
right,
it's part of Image's value price trade program. They've also got a cool thing called Image First, where they reprint key issues for 99 cents.
Right.
And so issue one is 99 cents, for crying out loud, in print.
Right.
And so it's super easy for people to dive in and get and get caught up on the story. One of the things that's kind of an advantage too is that having that break between arcs allows people to get caught up and,
mm-hmm,
hear about the series,
right,
from their friends, and then by the time the new arc starts, they're ready to rumble, you know. So,
I think it's a good, good strategy. A lot of people are doing it now.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's all well and good to want to have a monthly book, but it takes a Steven more than 4 weeks to draw most of the issues.
So the first two issues I drew in a month each, and I was so exhausted because there's so much detail that I was doing like 18-hour days.
Those backgrounds, he's drawing all the buildings.
Yeah, they were really taking a lot of time, and my son would come and be like, "Dad, let's play." And after a while, I was like, "Man, maybe we need me to set this story in like outer space." I gotta take a little more time to do my pages.
Right.
So now it's about a 5-week schedule for the book. So essentially, by the time we're finishing an arc, we're right down to the wire on it. Because we built the buffer, and then we eat it up over the course of the release.
Yeah, and the last issue, 15, was really long. So
yeah.
Actually,
what happened, and this is the thing, so Image doesn't tell us what to do editorially, which is amazing. But we had built up so much plot that by the time I got to issue 15, I've been doing this for a few years, and I'm pretty good at it, but even still, when you're actively scripting the pages, you hit a moment where you go, okay, I need more space, or I have to rejig this. This isn't coming down on the page the way I anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
And so normally our issues are 22 pages. And I looked at this and I said, I can deliver all the plot in 22 pages, but the big payoff moments should be bigger. And it annoys me that we're going to truncate them. And so I asked Steve, can I blow it out to 26 pages?
It was 27.
Well, it was, because the final was a 2-page spread.
Yeah.
But I said, if you just want to do a 1-page, you can. It should be 26, and then you decide, I would just do 27. So, you know, 5 extra pages. You couldn't do that in a Marvel or DC comic.
Right.
I can't just walk to my boss and say, hey, can you add an extra 20% to the issue?
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Right.
They're not going to give you that kind of freedom. Image basically eats up all their ads. The book literally went from cover to cover. We had no ads. We had no editorial page. It was just story,
right,
for the same cover price, because we said we wanted to do more pages, you know? And that's the kind of flexibility that we can have. And now it reads the way I want it to, and it's beautiful, and it's good. It's the way it should be. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I guess one last thing, and then we'll wrap it up. We talked a little bit before we started recording about working as creator-owned and working for like a DC or Marvel, and kind of like the pay structure, or
sure,
how they pay,
so
how you work.
Yeah. So I do commercial work. Steven's done commercial work, and it's great working on properties, particularly stuff you know. Like, I'm writing the Dungeons & Dragons comic right now, and I was a huge tabletop nerd. Working on D&D is amazing. It's a great, honor, and it's a thrill to be able to contribute to something. I'm writing Thunderbolts for Marvel, which is amazing. You know, the Winter Soldier is in the new Captain America movie, and the Winter Soldier leads the Thunderbolt team. So I'm writing Bucky. Like, this is very cool stuff. But at the end of the day, like, I don't own any of that. I don't have any control over it. I can make suggestions. I can be involved. But, you know, a year later, they could change everything, and that's their prerogative. They own it. It's their corporate property, you know. The wonderful thing about doing creator-owned is that we are making the book that we've always wanted to make. We're doing the thing that we want to do the way we want to do it, you know?
And with the people we want to.
And the people we want to. And if it fails, that's our fault, you know? And if it succeeds, it's based on our good judgment or whatever. And Image Comics in particular is really unique in this business. So there are other companies that do creator-owned comics, and most of them are some form of ownership and profit participation,
okay,
where you'll get a certain amount of money up front, and then you get more on the back end based on how well the book does, and the publisher has a stake in it so that they can sell it in media, so they can try and get movies going or whatever. Image was founded by six creators who wanted to completely control their own destinies. You know, some of the biggest guys in comics, Todd McFarlane, Jim Lee, Rob Liefeld, all those guys. And so they created a system where Image is literally, the company is like just a publisher in the sense they have the Image eye, that logo. They put it on a book. They publish the book. They take a base fee, and then everything else the book makes goes to the creators.
Okay, wow.
If the book fails, then that may be way less than you would make at another publisher.
Right.
But if the book succeeds, it is geometrically larger, like ludicrously larger than what you would get at another publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Or in some cases, what you could get writing X-Men or anything else for even the big two. If you have a highly successful Image book, Marvel or DC could not afford you anymore. You are literally controlling your own destiny and making a mint doing it. So we're not in that space as much as I would love to be. We're on, I'd say, there are books and Image that do not succeed, and that's, you know, the nature of the game when you're creating your own stuff and you're putting it out there and hoping there's an audience. We're the lower end of the successful scale. The book makes enough money that Steven is able to make it his full-time job, and he's got a family and two kids.
Right.
It doesn't pay my full-time. I've got a day job, and I still write freelance. But the book is sustainable. I can pay the colorist. I can pay the letterer. Steven gets paid. And we have money left over at the end to do profit participation for all of us. So we're able to keep doing the book. With the third arc, we hit a point where the monthly issues, there's a slow accrual, and not accrual, attrition that happens over time.
Right.
And so now more of our money is coming from the trade paperbacks than from the monthly issues.
Okay.
But that's a natural part of the book market.
Also, digital is doing really well.
Yeah, digital is a whole other game now where you're selling bits, you know, like online, and you're also getting, you know, but it's real money, obviously, you're making money.
Right. But it's hard to gauge because you don't get a monthly report like you do for the comic.
Right.
It's twice a year.
So even as a creator, you don't get a, like, you sold
this
many.
We get reports. We do, but twice a year on trade paperbacks and digital.
Okay.
The monthly issues, we get a monthly report.
Yeah.
Okay. So because I know that's one thing people always talk about. Oh, this book's not, it's doing maybe okay, but apparently the digital sales are crazy.
Right.
They don't
know
what the numbers.
We know what our digital sales are, but Image doesn't, none of the publishers actually want their digital numbers published for some reason, which is a little infuriating.
Right.
I don't know why everyone's really afraid. They're afraid that they're going to cannibalize their print sales or that comic book shops are going to lose their minds. You know what I mean? So,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, we have readers who tell us, I buy the paper and then I buy digital, which is great.
Yeah, in some cases, yeah. All people that buy digital, but then they come to a convention, they meet me in person, and they want something signed.
Right.
So they'll buy the book right from me, which is great, you know.
I did the same. Well, I didn't buy it from you, but I...
Yeah, brought it.
I read digitally, and I was like, what are they going to sign? My iPad? Well, my iPad's
right?
Old. I'm about to get rid of it. So I bought the deluxe hardcover.
I mean, and you know,
I bought it. I bought it online from Amazon, and it cost, Amazon Japan was, ship it here, which was going to take a month, it was kind of expensive, and
wow.
Then it was cheaper, it was the same price to buy from Amazon in the States and have it two day shipping.
Oh wow, it's up at Kinokuniya in Shinjuku. You can actually they're selling it for us. And
oh wow,
they tell us it sells really well.
Yeah, I want to get over there and see the actual setup that they've got.
You guys, you have a lot of Japanese fans. Are they reading it in English or
a lot of them
reading
in English? But then Steven's got a doujin version that he published.
A lot of them are reading in English, and then some just their English isn't to the level they can read it. And I realized I just felt strange that we were selling a book and people were like, "I like the pictures," and they didn't know what was going on. So we translated the first 5 issues and we made a doujinshi version with just the line art,
mm-hmm.
so it's black and white, and then a colored cover. We use the same cover, but the inside's all line art, and we started selling those, and it turns out that we started getting requests to reprint it because a lot of people, they're buying the monthly issues and they're buying the trades. They just can't read it. And so, you know, we made this available for them. And I think that's a really, for us at least, it was great to help our readers here. And it actually helped gain readership.
Yeah, and at Kamitia, we have people bring the doujin for me to sign as well.
Right.
And then we have people buying them, obviously, on the spot, which was cool.
Yeah, and then we have people bring us fan art, which was great.
That was mind-blowing.
Cool.
That was the coolest. There was, people bringing fan art over or talking about, you know, I was at, before I flew to Japan, I was at another convention in Calgary, Alberta,
mm-hmm.
and we had cosplayers who came over.
Did you have any cosplayers? Well, I guess there was no cosplayers.
No cosplayers at Kamitia, but we had cosplayers at Calgary, Alberta.
Okay.
So I had these girls who were dressed as Rory and Ayane, and they were great. It was really awesome. So make sure I got photos. They're going to be on the letters page of the next issue and stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, it's very cool. That kind of stuff is just so gratifying. I can't adequately express to you
mm-hmm.
creating something and having people want to dress as those characters and that they feel so connected to them that they want to visually look like them or be like them or, you know, show us their passion for what we're doing. It's nothing better.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to wrap it up there. If you listeners, if you want to check out Wayward, you can find it, Comixology. Ask your local shop to order it. You know, the trades are out now. Find the single issues. You got a couple months to catch up until issue 16, which is coming out. Sorry, what did you say?
September.
September.
And
so you still got time for the previews? Sorry, Jim.
Yeah, no worries. If people want to just get caught up in general on find out about other stuff I'm doing, at jimzub.com, I've got, you know, interviews about Wayward and stuff like that. We've also got a bunch of tutorials about how comics are made. So, essentially, it's like, how a comic is written, how to promote your work, how the creator-owned comics kind of economics work
mm-hmm.
as well. And I had such a good response to that tutorial material that I put together a Patreon page, which is basically twice or three times a month I'm posting scripts and outlines so you can actually see this is the real document that Steven or, you know, John Malin at Marvel, who's doing my Thunderbolts book, or Max Dunbar, who's drawing Dungeons and Dragons. This is the script they get. So if you have any aspirations to write comics or understand how the medium works, or if you're just like a process junkie and you find this stuff fascinating, you can dig in and read some of that stuff.
So be sure, guys, to check out Jim's Patreon over at his website, jimzub.com.
And
the third trade comes out, I think, at the end of this month.
That's right.
The end of May.
Yeah, Out from the Shadows, Wayward Volume 3.
Volume 3. Thunderbolts, number 1, just came out last week.
Yep.
I'm not sure when this is airing, but it's out this month in May. So guys, check out that from Jim. And Jim also did Figment recently with Marvel.
That's right, Disney and Marvel co-production. Yeah, it was a
right.
ton of fun.
So check that out. It's a lot of fun. You know, good all ages book too. Wayward, not all ages. So that's kind of a caveat we should add
yeah,
right there.
Yeah. Not all ages.
Not at all.
They some gore and they talk like teenagers talk. So if language is not your thing, then be ready. Thanks guys for listening. Thank you guys for doing the interview.
No, thank you.
Our pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Do you think you're gonna be able to isolate the